about healthcare, you heard about agriculture, you heard about education. So I think I'm going to save 5 minutes by not giving you too much context, given that the panelists from the previous session spoke at length about these things. I will also talk about certain efforts we are currently driving, again, obviously time permitting, but then certain areas where we believe not just India, but the entire region, entire emerging markets economy actually can benefit from those projects and basically see how we can take them forward. So to start with, very quickly, we have 6 labs across the world. As you can see on the map, there are 3 in the US, 1 in Redmond, where our mothership is, 1 in New England, 1 in New York, and 3 outside the US. So there's 1 in India, that's the lab I come from. There's 1 in Asia, in China, in Beijing, and there's 1 in England. Our mission is very straightforward. 1, we want to advance the field in whichever areas we choose to work in. So we basically decide our own agendas, and we work in areas which we find to be relevant to the, you know, the market. And also, obviously, because we all work for Microsoft, we also want to see that whatever innovations and disruptions we are able to bring about are relevant to the company as well. The India lab, very specifically, right, focuses across these broad areas. So we have people who work, you know, in computer foundations. We have people who work in systems. We have people who work in applications, so machine learning, again, I'm sure a lot of sessions around that, and it's a buzzword right now. So we have a bunch of people who are doing a lot of stuff in machine learning. We have a lot of people who work in natural language processing, because that's also for emerging markets an area which is very, very relevant, and a lot of research needs to still happen to actually ensure the state of the art goes to the next level. We have a very interesting group, which is, again, unique to the India lab. It's called Society and Technology. So this is actually a bunch of people who have varied backgrounds. So there are people who are ethnographers, there are computer scientists, there are applied scientists. And the entire objective of this group is to look at problems which are there at the ground level. So they don't really think of, you know, somebody having a computer first or a phone first and then work backwards. Instead, they look at solutions which could impact, you know, billions of people or millions of people. And I come from India, so I heard big numbers in the previous you know, panel as well. India has a population of 1.2 billion people, right? So anything that you design and you want to scale, you have to ensure that the technology is relevant to people. So before I switch to projects, right, most of the projects I'm going to talk about today are actually part of that group, the group called Technology for Emerging Markets. They are the guys who have actually done some of the projects I'm going to talk about. So to start with, very quickly switching to projects, right? So healthcare. So again, previous panel had it well covered. But I'm going to talk about a project called 99 Dots. And before I get started, I'll basically show you this slide. So how many of the people in this room actually knew this fact, that tuberculosis is actually the number one infectious disease killer? Did you know this? In fact, even we did not, right? So if you look at this picture, we keep talking about cholera, we keep talking about plague and so on. But TB happens to be the number one infectious disease killer across, you know, all such diseases. Now, before I actually move further and talk about the solution that we have designed and implemented at scale in India, I'll show you a video. It's actually an 11-minute video, so I'm not going to play the entire thing. But what I'm going to do is I'll quickly show you the first 2-3 minutes, which will give you a sense of how big this problem is and why this needs some sort of technology intervention, not really, you know, super cool or super fancy technology, but some sort of technology intervention for us or for healthcare professionals to be able to scale and reach out to broader audiences. So let me play this for you. And this was shot with real people, real patients.
मेरा काम है सुबह अपना कटिंग करना, कपड़े को काटना, फिर उसे अपने उसी कटिंग को बनाना, फिर शाम को अपना तैयार करना, प्रेस प्रेस मार के रख देना, मैं टाइम देता हूँ, ग्राहक आते हैं अपना ले जाते हैं, पैसे दे जाते हैं.
Your father loves you very much, right?
चुटकी बनाऊं, जेंसी बनाऊं, लेडीज बनाऊं और सबके बनाता हूं, घोड़ा, बिल्ली, कुत्ता, बंदर सबके बना देता हूं.
मैं पहले तो मेरे दर्द हुआ था यहाँ पर पेट में, पसली से नीचे सफदरजंग से मेरे मुझे बताया गया रिम टीबी है.
तुम्हें पता है कि तुम बीमार हो, तुम्हें कुछ बीमारी है, तुम्हें मालूम है? हाँ हाँ
This could be a real disaster in public health. So it's everyone's business to understand and combat tuberculosis.
They're basically two
So I'll stop there, but I'm guessing this gave you a real sense of how big this problem is. And as you saw, the people who were, you know, part of the video, hardly any of them actually had a phone or a smartphone or a computer and so on, right? So before I describe the project, let me also give you some context. So it's not that this disease right now is not dealt with. There are governments and organizations who are obviously trying very, very hard to ensure that they, you know, deliver medicines to people who are in need, ensure they cure them, because TB is curable. But then what happens is that there are multiple hoopla's involved when a patient is first diagnosed with tuberculosis and when he's actually going through the treatment. So the first problem with the treatment of tuberculosis is that the duration of a treatment for TB is around 6 months. It's not that you take 2 pills or 4 pills and you feel good. It's you have to adhere to the treatment for over 6 months in order to fully recover from tuberculosis. Now, what happens is the kind of people who actually get infected with this disease are typically, you know, people that you saw on the video, tailors, laborers, and so on. So they start taking medication, and over a period of time, let's say over after 1 month or 2 months, they start feeling better, and that's when they believe that they're fully recovered, and they end up giving up all the treatment going forward. Now, because of this, they end up developing a strain which is drug resistant. So then it's actually an even more severe problem because they gave away the treatment in the middle of the entire 6 month duration. They develop a strain called drug resistant TB, and that is next to impossible to cure. Hence, a lot of people lose lives because of tuberculosis. So this project 99 DOTS, so DOTS stands for directly observed therapy. So currently, again, the way medication is done is that if you are a TB patient, you go to one of these government centers which are spread across the country. You go take your pills, and the person who's there at the center marks a tick against your name saying that you've taken the medication. Again, the next day you come back, you take the pills, and the same process, right? So as you can imagine, this is not really scalable. So 99 DOTS, when it started, the idea was that given the fact that all you want to monitor is whether or not, one, the patient has medicine in his or her hand, and number two, using technology, can you track whether the patient has taken medication? Because if you are able to track, then you can do most of the things and solve most of the problems that I discussed right now using technology. So this is how it is, right? So what you see here, the red graphic here, is the pill box, is the pills that are given to any patient who has TB on day one. On the left, what you see is actually a specially designed envelope that we have created. So researchers, the guy you saw on screen, Bill Thies, he and his team actually created a special design for this envelope. Now, when a patient comes to the DOTS center, he basically receives this pill box in this specially customized envelope. Now, you must be wondering what is there in the envelope that, you know, I'm talking about. So I'm going to explain that next, right? Now, what happens is that within the specially designed envelope, every day a patient is supposed to take 2 pills. And the moment he pops the second pill, there is a number that gets disclosed. This number is free, of course. So a patient, all he has to do is basically give a missed call on this number, and then automatically on the system gets to know that the system has actually, the person has taken the medication and he's on track. So this is how it works, right? So as I said, it goes in. As a patient, I receive this. I start taking my pills. At the second pill, I get to see a number. I call on that number, just a missed call, because again, you have to be very conscious of the cost as well, you know, attached to phone calls and so on. So all you have to do is give a missed call. And based on the combination of caller ID and the numbers that we actually record in the system, we get to know that you have taken your medicine. Now, this opens up a whole lot of things that you can do using technology, right? So the first one, you can send reminders to patients. So if, for example, you observe that the patient has not taken a pill or he's not given a missed call on the number you've given, you can actually send reminders on regular phones, not even smartphones. You could send alert to providers. In this case, it's the government who's trying to drive, you know, a lot of incentives around people who take medication and recover. And then you could do a lot of analytics for supervisors. So just to give you a sense, and this is a real dashboard. I mean, it may be slightly dated, but it's a real dashboard, right? So you see, we track patients, you know, as in green and reds and so on. And whenever a patient misses a particular dose, the system can actually send alerts and gives you an opportunity to actually bring him back to the treatment plan. So given we've done multiple pilots, and this has been going on over the last 2.5-3 years, if I'm not wrong. We've done multiple pilots. And recently, the government of India realized that this could actually solve a problem to an extent where a lot of people who right now are anyways, you know, dropping off medication or not really benefiting from the medication could leverage the system to come back on track. So they have made an announcement recently where all the co-affected patients with HIV and TB are going to be administered medication through $99. So we actually have taken this project to Africa as well. We are talking to Ethiopia, and you know, they've shown a lot of interest. All the countries where that is actually a big problem, a lot of people we have been talking to, and we are happy to, you know, take it further to other countries where you feel that something like this could actually solve a problem. Now, very quickly, switching gears. So now I'm going to talk about agriculture, right? So again, that was another topic that was covered in the previous discussion, previous panel. So I'm going to talk about two projects, and each of them are quite unique, and you will see, you know, how we are trying to bring two and two together. So what is the agriculture challenge right now, right? So the challenge is that the world needs a massive increase in agricultural yield. And, you know, we have to double the yield by 2050 without disturbing, you know, or in fact, on the current arable land. At the same time, we have to ensure that we are sustainable in the long term and we don't, you know, impact certain factors such as, you know, carbon emission and soil quality and so on. With that in mind, right, so this again is a project that has been going on for the last three and a half years. I'll again play a video, and this also happens to be the second session after lunch and probably the third last before the close or something, right? So I'm going to use a lot of videos to kind of keep you engaged. So I'm going to play another video, this is a smaller one. This will give you a sense of the problem that I'm going to describe and the solution that we have in mind and our experiences with the pilot so far.
This area is known as Stewart's Landing, and this is Dancing Crow Farm.
One of the world's problems is yield. How do you double the yield by 2050 to feed the growth of the population in the world? This is a project that we recently started. What we want to do is we want to enable data-driven farming. The first goal is to give a real-time view of the farm, the real-time pulse of the farm to the farmer, saying, hey, this is what your farm is doing right now. So how do you even connect these farms to the internet? It's so far remote, the cell carriers have very little incentive to provide connectivity in the farms.
The system that we have deployed here is measuring soil temperature and moisture, and it's coming from this sensor.
Here what you see is a white spaces device. The idea that we had was a farmer buys a white space router, plug it in the farm, and your entire farm is connected. Now you can connect multiple devices, and connectivity is cheap. So you can actually deploy many more sensors in the farm. You could have a dense deployment of sensors getting real-time view of all the parts of the farm, not only your soil and moisture data, but this is a high bandwidth connection. You can connect cameras, get real-time views from the farm. So once you have all this data, you could then analyze the data to predict what the future would look like.
I'm actually really looking forward to how the process will change. This last year has been mainly a data gathering, information collecting year for the Microsoft research team. I'm really looking forward to seeing what research they've gathered this year, putting that together with what I think is going to happen next year, and make predictions for what I should plant when and where.
So as I said, this video is also slightly dated, and this is when the experiment actually started. So, and by the way, at MSR, this is how we do the experiments. We actually go to the farm, figure out what works, what doesn't work, come back, iterate, and see if we can create solutions around that, right? So given all this, it's not that there are no efforts going on in this area. I'm sure most of you in this room would agree that there are a lot of people who are trying to do a lot of things, and a lot of you know, things are getting improved as we speak in agriculture as well. There have been certain approaches around precision agriculture where people are talking about, you know, how to optimize the way you do irrigation, how do you use fertilizers in a better way, you know, how can you do variable seeding where you actually group seeds and plant it at a location where, you know, the soil is actually more fertile. Many of them are more analytics driven, right? So there are genetic variations depending on farm characteristics. People are trying to create insights and help a farmer in terms of making him more smart, giving him more options to choose from, and do things the right way. The biggest problem, even now, and again, you can, I'm happy to listen from you as well, is how do we get data? And even though there are ways of getting data, the main goal is how do you keep on getting continuous data? Because you can create a machine learning model which can do all of these things, but it has to improve itself, and that will only happen when you collect more and more data. So what you see right now, in fact, in the video as well, this is at a real farm in the United States. And in the US, the scenario that we could actually see was the nearest power available to this farm was around 0.5 mile, and the nearest internet was close to 1 mile. So given this scenario, it is very tough to kind of keep getting the continuous stream of data that I've been talking about. In terms of IoT for agriculture, so farm beats, we say it's basically nothing but a set of technologies which could actually very well be grouped as IoT for agriculture, right? So there are two key things that you want to look for, right? Timely data and models and analytics. Obviously, once you have data, you could do a lot of automation. So you could figure out when to do irrigation, how to do things at a given point, at the relevant time, and so on. The first step for all of this is collection of data, and that's what FarmBeats is all about right now. So as we speak, we have multiple deployments going on across the world, and most of them are currently focused on, the first phase of this project is focused on the first two line items. Going forward, obviously, we also want to build a lot of machine learning models and do automation for this area. The current state of the art, as I was saying earlier, right? So there's a lot of hype about sensor-driven agriculture. These sensors that you also saw in the video that I played, there are a lot of these sensors that go into the soil and water and so on. However, they are too labor intensive, right? Similarly, if you go for automated sensors, the other bigger challenge is the cost. They are really, really expensive, and you can't really expect a farmer to actually pay that amount of money to be able to generate data that they can give to you to make sense for that farmer eventually. Drones, again, this was something that was discussed in the last panel. So we obviously know that drones can be of high utility if they fly around a farm and collect data and so on. But then again, they have limited battery life, and you don't know the ground truth data because all it's doing for you is basically getting an aerial view and giving you that information. With FarmBeats, the vision is to actually combine all of that. So I was talking about sensors. We have created our own sensors which are very, very, inexpensive. So if typical sensors that you saw previously cost you 5 to 8K or whatever, we are trying to work very, very hard to ensure we bring that into a cost factor that anybody can afford. So maybe a government can partner, or the farmer himself is able to actually go leverage the kind of sensors we drive. What it lets you do is, because we collect data from various sources, so we fly out a drone, I'll show that to you in the next slide as well. We collect data from different sources. We are able to create a spatiotemporal view of the farm. And once you have this view of the farm, you could do multiple things. So in terms of agriculture services, the vision that we have in mind is that we want to be able to provide yield prediction, we want to talk about precision irrigation, we want to talk about pest infection, and we want to tell you as a farmer, which are the areas where you have to go apply fertilizers on time. So in terms of architecture for FarmBeats, it's pretty straightforward, right? So what you see right now is a bunch of sensors, and this is again a real deployment that I'm showing you right now. So there's a bunch of sensors which are deployed at various places. This image that you see here is actually the real sensor. So, it's pretty straightforward. There's a camera attached to it. It has sensors which are plonged around the sensor itself, the main sensor itself. And they are distributed across the farm so that you get data from, no matter how big a farm is, you keep continuous, keep getting continuous data in a real-time basis. And on top of that, we obviously, in places where we can, fly drones to get the aerial view and then do a lot of other things. So the other side of FarmBeats, the other advantage of FarmBeats, which again Ranveer mentioned in the video, is essentially the fact that from the architecture that we have drawn out, a lot of the computing happens at the IoT edge level. Now this IoT edge level that you see, the farm aggregator, right? This is something which is sitting in the farm itself. And because it's sitting in the farm itself, you don't really need fancy internet, or you don't need to put everything on the cloud and get computation done. It's all sitting there, right, at the farm itself. Most of the computing happens in real time for the farmer, and the farmer gets to do a lot more compared to what he was previously able to. In terms of technical challenges, right, so I'm sure many of you have questions around this, how feasible this is, and, I'm talking about cost on one side and talking about drones on the other side. So I'll cover some of them here and then obviously take more after the session. So connectivity is a huge issue. So what we have tried to do is we have basically tried to leverage the concept of TV white spaces within the farm. So when we create an IoT environment at the farm. So instead of actually having each device talk to the cloud directly or use internet for each device, we are essentially trying to see if we could create, you know, an environment inside the farm where all these devices, you know, send data to the IoT edge. And then IoT edge at some point, whenever it has connectivity, syncs back to the cloud and does a lot of stuff. In terms of power, again, in countries where sun is not really a problem, we have been able to successfully experiment that using solar-powered sensors, you are able to achieve, you know, at least 80% of what you really want to. And any data is good data. So in places where actually power is a problem and sun is not, we have been actually experimenting with having solar panels that could power these devices and so on. And obviously, environmental conditions are in nobody's control. So to cope with this, what our researchers have actually been doing is actually think of algorithms which could in some way incorporate, you know, these angles and hence be able to actually still give you results that you expect. Drones as well, there are a lot of challenges. It's not as simple. I mean, it's good to just fly for fun, but when you are using data that is coming from a drone, a set of challenges show up, right? So the main ones that I've listed here are the ones that we believe need to be addressed immediately or had to be addressed immediately, right? So one is ease of use. I mean, not every farmer will be able to fly a drone. I mean, you can't just go and plonk a drone in a farmland and ask a farmer to actually go fly it around and, you know, give you data. Large farming areas, the battery life of a drone is limited. It lasts only 20, 25, minutes. So in cases where you have farms of 100 acres or 200 acres, something this, again, could not be able to, could be a blocker to your scaling. And then the videos are huge. So imagine a drone flying for 20 minutes, the amount of video that it can collect and it wants to give it back, it's just humongous, right? And not all of it is sensible. So to address that part or these challenges, researchers at Microsoft in Redmond as well as in India have actually worked out all of these algorithms on their own. So what you see in pink here are algorithms that we have designed in-house to somehow, you know, cater to this problem, these three major problems, and to see to what extent are we able to optimize performances and inputs that we get from a drone device. So I'm not going to go into each of these algorithms, but if any of you are interested, post a session, I'm happy to talk about them as well. Again, I'm sure some of you had this question as well, right? Cost and drone, both of them don't sound well together, right? So if you don't have a drone, what do you do? So we recently did an experiment in India where, by the way, in India, flying drones is not allowed at all. So you can't really do anything even if you can afford a drone. By law, it's not allowed, it's prohibited. So we recently realized that what are we trying to do with drones, right? So we are just trying to gather data, get aerial views of the farm, and somehow be able to transmit that data back to the IoT edge. So for that, instead of a drone, we actually used a helium balloon. So what you see is, again, from a real farm in India, where we had a balloon, helium balloon filled with the helium air gas. We flew it over the farm, and it was actually able to give us the kind of data we really wanted. So we realized that drone is not really a limitation for scaling a project of, you know, this nature. So today it's drones. Tomorrow, imagine there is a tractor going in the farm. You can tie a balloon like this, so a person doesn't even have to walk around, and the balloon is able to capture all the data, transmit back to the IoT edge. In terms of services, what can it do, right? So given you have so much data, you have data from the farm, you have data from weather agencies, you have historical data of what has happened in that particular month and so on, you can do a bunch of things, right? So just to give an example, from the video, you can sample images. You can create panels using those images. Using those panels and, you know, sensor stream that's coming your way, you can actually create heat maps. Using all of that, you can create irrigation scheduling, for example, right? So these are the bunch of services that you can actually do. I'm not saying all of this is being done right now, but then given that you have the baseline covered, you have the data angle covered, you can do so much more compared to, you know, what you were historically able to do. So that was about FarmBeats. Now I'm going to quickly talk about, in fact, again, show you a video of another project that we did in India. So the IDC, India Development Center team, was talking to a lot of people who work with farmers, and they realized that one of the biggest challenges where technology intervention has to be made now is helping farmers decide when to sow. Because what happens is, given the climate change and given, you know, so many other parameters, what farmers do right now in a farm is all based on intuition. So they basically figure out that, okay, last year in June, it rained in the third week. So maybe end of April is a good time to sow or not sow based on the crop they don't want to do what they want to see sow, right? But again, as I said, we live in a world where we cannot even predict what the weather is going to be 2 days later. And when I say we are people who have access to, you know, apps and so on. Imagine the sake of a farmer who's there without any internet connectivity, without any app that he can use or leverage in real time to decide. So let me show you the video first, and then I can talk about it a little more.
Preparing for agriculture is a fragile soil-water equation, where timeliness and precision decide on the returns. Even a week's delay in rains can spoil the harvest. Each year, farmers in Andhra Pradesh bring all their traditional wisdom into play to anticipate the best time for sowing their crops. But with climate change and a rainfall deficit, the stakes for getting the timing right are rising. For them, the difference between a profitable year and a failed harvest is information on the optimal time to plant their fields.
Sowing date as such is very critical to ensure that they get a good crop stand. And if it fails, then a lot of costs are involved in the seeds as well as the fertilizer applications. So the most important challenge for the farming community in the rain-fed agriculture areas is when to sow the crop, and that precise information, which is based on the scientific data as well as the scientific observations, is not available to the farmers. With this background, then ICRISAT and Microsoft together decided to develop a computer-based sowing date application.
The sowing date application uses powerful cloud-based predictive analytics to advise farmers on the best time to sow their crops depending on weather conditions, soil, and other indications. It uses Microsoft Cortana Intelligence Suite, including machine learning and Power BI. Besides this, with a personalized village advisory dashboard, users have access to an instant overview of factors that determine a healthy crop yield. The tool helps with insights around soil health, fertilizer recommendations, and 7 days weather forecast.
This application can be used for any state, any district in the country, as well as outside the country.
All of which means farmers have some help from modern technology to add to their traditional wisdom. This translates into healthier crops, increased incomes, and happy families across rural Andhra Pradesh.
So as you saw, we've already done a pilot with this, and this is again a video shot on the real farm. The first pilot was with the 175 farmers in the state of Andhra Pradesh that you saw on the screen. And using this app, we were able to see the results, right? So the impact was that we saw the set of people that we worked with, we saw a 30% increase in the yield for that set of people using this technology. So if this is something that is relevant to your region as well, please come talk to us. We'll be happy to see how we can actually, you know, make this more extensible, go deploy it for your region as well, and help people in that sector. Okay, so again, the third aspect, right? So now I'm going to talk about certain projects or other efforts we've been driving in skilling and education. So again, I don't really need to, you know, kind of reiterate the need of education and need of technology in this space. Given the volumes that we face across emerging markets, we definitely need technology interventions, right? So we started a project called Massively Empowered Classroom, again in India Lab, and this was around late 2012. And that was around time when MOOCs such as Coursera, edX, all of them were getting really, really popular. Now the interesting fact there was that even though these MOOCs were getting really popular, most of the people who were signing up for these courses, at least from emerging markets like India, China, and so on, were enthusiast learners. So that opened up a very interesting question for our researchers. So they wanted to understand that given the availability of such high quality content online, right? You have MOOCs, you have YouTube, you have so many other sources, and students, they are supposed to learn. I mean, they go to school or they go to college just because they have to learn, right? Why is there a mismatch? Or what can you do using technology to solve this problem, you know, bridge this gap, and make students access this great quality content that's available online? So with that vision, we decided we'll create our own platform, just to experiment. This is like 3 years ago. We decided we're going to create our own platform and basically bring in certain things that exist and create certain things from an architecture standpoint that our researchers believed could address this gap that I was talking about, right? So the first one, we said it's going to be a blended learning model. So blended learning in our case actually meant that we are going to blend experiences. So we are not going to say that as a student, you have to go and take everything online, but we are going to tell you that certain side of things, a certain amount of content that you're going to view or leverage is going to be online. Rest could happen in a hybrid model or done through a teacher and so on. Also, in a typical MOOC, right, what happens is there's one teacher. So let's say I'm a professor, and I'm teaching millions of students at the same time. Now, as a local teacher in a particular university or a city or a state or a country, right, I have no incentive to tell my students to go and take a course on MOOCs, right? So we decided that the architecture we are going to create is going to be highly, highly localized. So what this means is that even though there's a huge repository of content that's available from day one, this content will flow down to each of the colleges or schools or universities or, you know, as you have it on the platform. And local teachers would be able to make interventions based on the local needs. So to give you an example, let's say, you know, in India, the deployment that we are running right now that you see here, it's, by the way, live, so you can go try it out. It's www.mecr.org. So the idea here is that there's a lot of content on 3 or 4, you know, computer science courses. These courses flow into 13 or 14 universities that we have as partners in the country. Each of these universities, again, have a set of colleges or departments which are part of the ecosystem. The content from the top flows to each of them, and at each level, there are local administrators or teachers, or owners rather, who can make, you know, interventions. So they can augment content, they can actually curate the entire content, they can add stuff that they want, they can remove whatever we have given and just administer, you know, the stuff that they want. Now what this brings on the table is two things. One, obviously localized control. So as a teacher, I have an incentive of putting in more content and actually easing my own job. I'll become more productive. And I have access to analytics. So I do not care what happens at the level of India, but I care about what is happening in my classroom. So with this, because you are in charge of your classroom, you can actually go ahead and leverage content which is available here. And again, I'm sure here as well, internet is a huge problem. I mean, it is a problem, maybe not huge, but it is a problem, right? And students often view stuff when they are on the go and so on. So again, for this, we from day one kept it as a part of the design angle that we had in mind, that we will ensure that there is possibility of online content dissemination. So we have phone apps, we have offline packages, and a lot of things. And we've seen actually a lot of usage of this compared to what we see on the real site. So as we speak, the current site itself has close to 500,000 students who are taking some course or the other, and thousands of them have actually been using the app and offline versions and all of that. So the app is available on Play Store. You can actually go play around with that as well if you feel that's of interest. Now, surprisingly, while we were doing experimentation, so as I said, as Microsoft Research, right, we try to do experiments and then, you know, give whatever we learn from the field to other groups within Microsoft to see and take it further. We realized that a platform like this is not really solving a problem for India, but it is very relevant to other markets as well. So this opportunity actually came to us. We did not really do any marketing and, you know, approach the government. The Jordan government came to us saying they want a very similar setup of MEC in their country. The problem statement is quite similar, even though the scale is obviously low, given our population. So the problem statement for them was that, you know, they have 13 public universities, some of them are very good, some of them are not good. So what can we do using technology to, one, bring everybody together on the same platform, and two, give this levels of control, interventions that we have. So, you know, on the other side, Microsoft as a company, we have a lot of other technologies like Office 365 and Power BI and so on. So we thought that this is a good opportunity for us to experiment, you know, a bigger application than just MEC. So we went ahead and deployed that as a pilot for them. And as we speak again, over the last year and a half, this has really, really scaled up in that country. And a lot of people are now using it. Close to 160,000 people are actually live on the platform, and the government plans to mandate it by December this year. So every student in every university in Jordan is going to be on the platform and take some courses there. Similarly, in Mauritius, this will probably be more familiar to you. We are doing a launch for this on 8th of this month. So from here, you know, we head to Mauritius. So the idea here was very similar. Distance learning, 200K students, you know, platforms exist, but they want hierarchy-based, role-based, those kind of things that I was describing with Jordan. Went ahead, created another solution for the context of Jordan, and the government actually has decided to adopt this. This is again, I mean, this requirement came from the government, and the Minister of ICT is actually going to launch this on the 8th of February, dedicating it to the country. Now, this one is interesting, so I'm actually running out of time, but I'll very quickly go through this as well. This came from the Ministry of Urban Development in India, right? So some of you may have heard of a campaign called Swachh Bharat. So Swachh Bharat stands for Clean India. And the problem statement for, and that happens to be the biggest priority of the current prime minister. So they are actually doing a lot of campaigns and, you know, promotional things to ensure that citizens and other people take necessary steps to make India a cleaner country. So one of the problems they had was creating awareness amongst municipal workers themselves, because they believe that the problem is not just citizens, it's also people who are responsible for keeping the areas clean, you know, people like municipal workers and so on. So they have a lot of content from USAID and other organizations. They again wanted the same hierarchy of, you know, control and content, as I was speaking about, to go ahead and do a deployment for them. So we decided, okay, this sounds like a good opportunity. And we were also planning to, around the time when the opportunity came, we wanted to experiment, you know, around the area of skilling. So we decided we'll go ahead and do this for them. And as of now, this is actually 2 weeks old. We have close to 500,000 people who are taking courses. So week by week, now it's plan of the major campaign that the government is running. There are incentives for people to take courses. So they go take courses, they go and report back to the government that they've taken a course, and based on that, they get certain things which actually count for their promotions and so on. So this, again, was a very, very interesting case study for us as MSR to be able to deliver value in a non-education, non-K-12 kind of an environment. On a lighter note, we were really, really surprised, and I'm sure a lot of people in the room, Manil is here, Prashant is here, we were really surprised that a platform like MEC that we have done for higher education could actually be leveraged to deliver courses like this. And this is also real, by the way. I mean, you can go to the site, you'll be fascinated by the kind of content that's available. Surprisingly, that is the need. I mean, people like you and I, we probably ignore, but that is the need, and a lot of people are actually going through courses on how to create toilets, how to maintain toilets, you know, what is the measures of sanitation that you have to take and so on. So all I'm saying is that doesn't matter which vertical you develop a particular technology for, you can find applications in a lot of other similar areas, and as long as you can scale, you can probably go keep deploying as well. Healthcare, similar problem. So I spoke about scaling, so you can realize hospitals across the world, right, have this problem, not just India. Across the world, they have a lot of non-clinical staff, clinical staff. They need to continuously upgrade their skills from time to time, right? Again, the same scenario, role-based. So the first customer came to us, you know, saying that they want a solution like this. We went ahead, deployed this for them, a completely different context. It worked for them, and now, obviously, because of what others see, a lot of other hospitals also want to go and deploy something of very, very similar nature. I'm quickly going to talk about one more project, and in fact, there are two more, but I'll speak about this and then see how we're doing on time. So while I was talking about education, right, one of the points which I'm sure may have crossed your mind was the fact that, I mean, how do you bring in people to the system, right? It's all good when you're talking about online education, blended learning, and so on. But that's good only when they are in the system. How do you bring them into the system, right? So this is some work, again, done by the India Development Center team, where the government gave them a problem statement. They said, we have so many students. We have millions of students. And again, this is the scale of students that they have. And many of them drop out. And they drop out because of certain factors which we know. Like, for example, they do not come from a very you know, high social economic background, or they don't like the teacher, or the teacher is not motivated enough, and so on. They know a lot of these factors. But then they do not know who is the most vulnerable candidate who would drop out, or who are the set of people who would drop out. So given the limited capacity that they have in terms of teachers and administrators, they do not know who to focus more on and who to focus, you know, who to just let it be, because they know they will, this guy will continue education and so on. So the India Development Center developed this solution using machine learning, where they ingested all of this data, historical data, and looking at this data, they were actually able to create dashboards which a teacher or an administrator could look at, and it would indicate who are the most vulnerable people who would drop out. So now instead, let's say in a scenario of 5,000 people, instead of focusing on all 5,000, you can narrow it down to those 500 or 1,000 or 100, whatever it is, and you know, ensure that they remain in the system. So this, obviously, given the fact that we're talking about scale here, something like this would really, really make sense. So with this as well, we've done multiple deployments. So the first one was in, again, the state of Andhra Pradesh. And we first started with 10 schools and 5,000 students. based on the success that we saw with the system, we kept scaling up. And now we are talking about millions across various states in the country. So a lot of governments, after seeing what they saw, are coming to us and saying that, you know, this is something that's very, very relevant for their context as well, and they would like to get going ASAP. Now, stitching all of them together, right? So I spoke about dropouts, I spoke about education, I spoke about skilling. All of you know that LinkedIn is also now part of Microsoft family. So there is a very, very, you know, there's a story here, and we can all figure out, you know, thinking, connecting the dots together. So going forward, one of the big bets that we want to take as Microsoft India is essentially create an end-to-end platform. So let's say you are somebody who's in a remote area of the country, right? We are able to predict that you probably would drop out. So we will continue, you know, counseling you and giving you right content. We'll make you learn stuff using a technology like MEC, where there's content available online, offline, and so on. Next step would be to take you to a platform like LinkedIn, because eventually the reason you're taking a training is because you want to get a job, right? And LinkedIn is where you get jobs. So we will essentially help you get to LinkedIn, where a set of employers will actually look at what you have done over the last 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, and so on. And then the chances of you getting a job would be probably way higher compared to what they were if you just came to LinkedIn directly, or, you know, any other employer set for that matter. So we are talking to a lot of companies in India to start with, who actually help getting these blue-collar people jobs. We are talking to them, ingesting a lot of scenarios, and hopefully in the next few months, we will be able to have a clear end-to-end path for anybody, anywhere in the world, who would want to go through this journey. The last, but not the least, citizen speech, right? So this is, again, very, very interesting. Now, this is a scenario from a state called Punjab in India, right? So there, what happens is that every month, the government gives out pensions to millions of people, 1.4 million people every month. And after they give out the pension, they have a call center deployed who calls a set of people, not everybody, but a subset of those people who are taking who are getting pensions, and basically gets the reaction. Are they happy? Are they sad? Are they satisfied? And these are not objective responses. These are responses that people actually speak out, and they are subjective. So, I mean, if I'm really unhappy, I can actually abuse the person on the other side of the phone as well. That also gets recorded, right? So it all happens. Now, before this technology was deployed for them, the state of the art was that all this data got collected. There were people manually looking at this, these call logs and call records and other things. And then, in a period of 2 or 3 or 4 months, they would create a dashboard based on manual entry and show it to the administrator saying, okay, this is how we are doing on the happiness index of people. So again, the team at India Development Center realized that, while we may not be able to do, stuff with 100% accuracy, which probably is true in manual cases as well, we can still automate a lot of it, right? So we applied a lot of speech analysis and recognition on all this feedback that we get, clubbed it with emotion recognition that we already know of. And then basically we were able to create and demonstrate that something that you would manually do over a period of 3 months, we could probably do it the next day because everything is getting recorded. So if you make calls today, by tomorrow, the minister of that state would actually get a dashboard that this is the happiness index. So what you would have fixed probably 3 or 4 months later, you could take remedial action right away. So this again saw, we started with Punjab. Now a lot of states are coming after us saying this is relevant to them too, because they have scenarios around this and they would want to go ahead deploy this as well. I am sadly out of time, but these are other areas we are looking at. So very quickly touching on the trusted data collaboration part, because I think somebody from the panel spoke about this too in the previous panel, right? So our vision going forward is now that we know that ML can probably solve real problems, to what extent we still have to see, but we obviously want as Microsoft Research, invest in this area and see how we can advance the state of the art. We want various bodies to come together, because more the data, the more the, the better the ML is going to be. So we are talking to various healthcare providers, we're talking to telecom regulators, banks, and so on, to see how we can make them collaborate securely on data and do, a lot of magic through machine learning. So with that, I'll stop. If you have any questions, feel free. And just one closing comment. All the projects that you saw here, right, are projects which are live and deployed. So if any of them are relevant to, areas you come from, or, things that you do, please come, feel free, come talk to us. We are here, and we'll be happy to explore how we can actually take this forward in your regions as well.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we won't be able to take any questions. Yeah. But a round of applause for you.
Thank you. Yeah.